On my show today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Andrew Semmel from Washington, D.C. He is in the Partnership for a Secure America. And basically, he works to get the world's nuclear arsenal reduced and make everyone safer. So,
I welcome Dr. Andy Semmel here to Cal's Radio in Sonoma County. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Andy is with the Partnership for a Secure America. And
I think it's we're talking about basically saving the world from the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. Is that the basic short of it?
And specifically a kind of a subset of that, because there was a nuclear security summit in Seoul earlier this week,
yes,
which was focusing on securing nuclear materials, the kinds of materials that can be used to make nuclear weapons.
Ah, the famous yellow cake. We'll have to talk about that later. But tell me, Andy, how did you get into this? You've had quite an incredible career so far in foreign policy and especially in the nuclear side of things. What got you into it to begin with?
Well, it's an interesting question. How does one, sort of end up in the profession that they end up in, even by happenstance? I started out as an academician, got my PhD from the University of Michigan, started teaching. Taught for a number of years, enjoyed that very much. Then on the lark, I took a fellowship in Washington, ended up in Washington. The old story is I came for dinner, I stayed for breakfast and lunch the next day. And so anyway, stayed around for a while in Washington, ended up working in the Senate, U.S. Senate, and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for more than a dozen years. And then I got an opportunity to go to the State Department, where I worked on nuclear nonproliferation issues. Mm. And that's really, really acquired some of my interests and expertise. Fascinating work.
Oh, it must be. Delving into, each country's most sensitive secrets, basically.
Absolutely. Including our own.
I bet that must be the worst, I would think.
Well, most of the nuclear materials that we're talking about, again, we're talking about fissile material, the kinds of materials, what we call weapons-grade nuclear materials, the kind that can be used in weapons. Most of it, a good chunk of it in terms of what's available in the world, is, of course, in the countries that have nuclear weapons, like the United States and Russia, but also France and Great Britain and China, but in scattered places elsewhere around the world.
Right. Well, the conference that was this week, there was 47 or so attendees. Does that mean we've got 47 at least potential bomb makers in the world?
No, I don't think so. That would be a misconception. There was actually more than 50 countries that were there, including a number of intergovernmental organizations like the IAEA and the UN and others. Hmm. There are 47 countries are at the 2010 nuclear summit here in Washington. They're in Washington, and this summit in Seoul, Korea, had around 53 or 54, I believe, countries that were there. These are countries which may have some nuclear activities in them. They may have, for example, nuclear power plants that generate electricity. 16% of the world's electricity is generated by nuclear power, for example. Mm. And there are about 40 countries or so that have nuclear power plants. But a number of countries also use nuclear materials for other things, for healthcare, for agriculture, and things like that.
Yeah.
But those are not weapons usable materials, but they can be dangerous nonetheless. So these are all countries that have concerns. And I think the real answer to your question is that this is a universal problem. If a nuclear weapon were to be detonated, let's say by some terrorist group, if they had the capability, the impact, not just where that devices detonated will be global, will be worldwide. It will change the way in which we live our lives in the future. Hmm. So it's a global concern, and that's why there that many countries showed up.
Interesting. Now, just on that randomness of terrorism and things, I mean, what are they more worried about, an individual person bringing in a bomb or one delivered by a plane or a missile from outside?
Well, it has to be all the above, I think. The focus of this summit in Seoul was to secure or to lock down these nuclear materials, particularly the most dangerous ones, which are weapons usable, that can be used to make a nuclear weapon. And there are over 100 sites around the world in which so-called highly enriched uranium and plutonium, these are the weapons usable materials, are found. Most of them are well protected, but not all of them are. And so what the summit is trying to do is to try to draw more attention to this issue among the various states that have these materials, to shed some public light and to add some public pressure to take the kinds of steps that are necessary to ensure that terrorist groups and other rogue elements who might want to have access to these materials and use them for malevolent purposes simply don't have that access. So this is what it's all about. So the place to focus most of the attention is at the site of where those materials are. You can protect them there physically from access, from being stolen, bartered, or whatever. Then I think there's a good chance that the wrong elements won't get their hands on these dangerous materials.
Yeah, it always makes me nervous that, human frailty, it's gambling just so much. Now, obviously, President Obama thought it serious enough to go there. Mm-hmm. What has been his policy since he's been in? Has he done enough? Is he been working in the right direction?
Yeah, I think you have to give him credit. I mean, in a sense, you'd have to go back even to 2009. For those of us who were in, follow these things closely, in 2009, the president gave a speech in Prague, the Czech Republic, in which he said a number of important things. But one of the things he said the world should commit itself to securing all vulnerable nuclear materials within the next four-year period. And he called upon the nations of the world to take this seriously. And then he called this first nuclear security summit in Washington, D.C. in 2010. And to draw more attention, to put pressure on countries to do things. It's what I call policy by itinerary. Heads of state are going someplace. They want to be able to say something constructive. In order to say something constructive, they have to do something constructive. For example, making commitments to eliminate their highly enriched uranium from their, from their power plants and so forth. This effort has been, in effect, spearheaded by the United States. The president taking the lead on that. You have to give him credit for it. He was thinking big, and they're still thinking big. We can get to this later, but I think they have to start thinking bigger than what happened in Seoul.
Right. Now, was that just having it in Seoul, South Korea, a pointed exclamation mark for North Korea, or how did that work out?
Well, what happened is somebody had to, the U.S. hosted the first one, so somebody had to host the second.
Okay.
And I think the Koreans stepped forward, and they may very well have had their neighbor to the north in mind on that to draw attention to them. But keep in mind that South Korea is an advanced industrial state, and it has a fairly sophisticated nuclear program, not a weapons program, but a nuclear program. It is a nuclear exporter. It is building nuclear power plants in various countries around the world. And in fact, interesting enough, we buy from them some major things. We, the United States, nuclear industry buys from them. So they're a very sophisticated country, and they've been very active in this area. So I think they wanted to step forward, and for that reason alone.
Well, fascinating. So, and what came of? How did it go? Is it like They go in the back rooms, then they come out and do a big final meeting. How is that played out there?
Well, I think it's probably best to describe it maybe a number of ways in which what happens is that between 2010 and 2012, where the, 2012 was where the last, during the week where the Seoul summit was, during that period of time, emissaries from the countries get together. They're called Sherpas. And Sue Sherpas, they're the number twos. And they begin to negotiate, and they meet periodically during the course of that two-year span and end up coming up with a draft communique on what they can all agree on, what they would like to do, and how they would like to present the results of the summit to the rest of the world. So that's a process that takes place between in the two-year hiatus between the two summits. When they get there, the countries around the table, give, in a sense, give country reports, give a status report on what they committed to the last time, how far they've progressed, and make new commitments, as the case may be. And then they issue another communique of what their, their intentions are, what they hope to achieve in the next period of time, and so on. But the third thing that happens is that there's very important conversations and meetings that take place in the back rooms, and one-on-ones in the corridors. We call it in diplomatic language on the margins of the summit itself.
Okay.
And these are important. President Obama, for example, was meeting with the president of Pakistan. He's met with President Medvedev of Russia, met with the Turkish president, met with the Chinese president. So you have these negotiations, these talks that take place on other issues. Of concern that we would have, or those heads of state might have.
Oh, I see.
Because the summit itself wanted to stay focused on, on the issues of nuclear security. But these other issues were being talked about, in the corridors and in the other rooms, as you pointed out.
And at the end of it, how did everyone feel? They'd achieved their goals, or it didn't seem like there was a lot of gaps somehow in what was wanted to come out of it.
Yeah, it depends upon where you're. There's an old phrase in decision making says where you stand depends upon where you sit, and depends on where you sit, you take a different judgment on where you stand on the achievements. I think it was an important achievement. In Seoul, I think countries, for example, from 2010, something like 80% of the commitments that were made by various countries, for example, to eliminate their highly enriched uranium get rid of it or eliminate it for that matter, about 80% of all those commitments were actually met, which is a pretty good, pretty good achievement in the diplomatic world. Many more commitments were made in Seoul as well, along the same kinds of constructive lines for ensuring that, terrorist groups and others don't get their hands on these dangerous materials. So in a sense, I think it moved the ball forward. It made the world and all of us a little more safer than it would have been in the absence of this summit. In my judgment, they need to go much farther and much faster. So I would say where I sit and my stand is that it made progress, it made made modest progress, but they've got to move faster and much more decisively than they have.
Well, that's it. The ideal goal, obviously, is to eliminate them totally as of tomorrow. How do you see that timeline with the way things are going? I mean, how far can America reduce anyway to that final point where they go under that magic point where they have less or can't protect ourselves?
Well, it's a good question, and that's always the difficulty. If you can, and your question is absolutely right on. You can set goals, but then the question is how to achieve those goals, how to really make them, how to implement them is a tough question. From my perspective, what happened, the nature of the, let's call it the global regime with regard to nuclear materials security, let's call it that, which is what the summits are all about, is one that is a patchwork of agreements and programs and other efforts that are almost all voluntary. That is to say, it's what we call, used to call, the state-centric system, in which states have the almost exclusive responsibility for doing these things, which means that not all states secure their materials well enough. Not all states have the same capability for doing it, the resources, the know-how, and so forth. So you have a patchwork of efforts that is very inconsistent. And, you know, if terrorists are really bent, they'll try to find the weakest link in all that system and try to exploit that to get their hands on these materials to try to fabricate some kind of weapons that they could use. What's really needed in this, and I think, and what really the summit, hopefully the next time in 2014, which may be the last summit, what they really need to do is move towards an international, what I call a framework convention, that would make countries would be bound to take certain steps. There will be set agreed upon standards that countries would have to follow, and they would be accountable for following them. In the absence of that, you have voluntary measures, which is basically the way the system exists now. And those voluntary measures, you know, it's on the goodwill of countries and their nuclear industries, their police forces, and so forth to enforce them, and it's very inconsistent around the world. So we've got to make that huge leap beyond these voluntary measures. Having said that, it's an enormously difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's making me incredibly uneasy just thinking, that it's just voluntary and we've got
mostly voluntary
yeah. and there's so much 100-odd sites scattered around the world.
But the point is the world is a lot safer than it was 15 years ago, believe me.
Okay.
And you know, when the 9/11 terrorist attacks hit the United States and in New York and Washington particularly, this whole issue was sort of catapulted to the top of the agenda. Truly, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration regard nuclear terrorism as the single most important threat to the United States and maybe to world security. And it was an issue that was not given much attention. But after 9/11, the realization set in that groups like al-Qaeda and others really were intent on getting their hands on these materials to try to use them. And once they had them, they certainly would use them. There was no mistake about that. And how to prevent that is what all these programs are about. And there's many other programs. But the Nuclear Security Summit is designed to give a sort of laser-like focus on what the world should be doing to make sure that these materials are not do not get into the hands of these dangerous groups.
Well, that's it. So in terms of monitoring, right now each country is there's no other external guidelines. Each country is just basically catch as catch can to do it.
Well, it's not quite that anarchic.
Okay.
What happens is the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna.
Yeah.
Has set established a set of guidelines in which they provide advice, they provide information, they provide equipment at times, and they set a whole set of guidelines which they offer to countries who are members of the International Atomic Energy Agency. There's over 154 countries, I think, in that organization.
Oh.
And but what happens is that the International Atomic Energy Agency cannot impose those standards on countries. They can simply provide the advice and information to them at the country's request. And what I'm saying is we need to go beyond that. It's a very important function that they provide. Don't minimize that.
Yeah.
Extremely important. But they're not. Those are not binding standards. They're all voluntarily accepted and practiced.
Yeah, and when do you think that convention will happen?
Well, you know, some of us in the now that I'm a private citizen and work on some of these issues, there are a number of groups, not just here in the United States and elsewhere, who are like-minded about this, and we want to try to make the case that we need to go farther and faster to begin developing this kind of international framework convention before it's too late. Rather than reacting to, you know, a catastrophe, we ought to try to be ahead of the curve rather than follow the disaster that might take place. I'm fairly confident that if the system that we have is pretty good system right now, but it can break down easily, and it's better to have a system with binding standards than one that's mostly voluntary.
Well, yeah, I mean, was it a couple of years ago that Air Force plane took off with live nuclear bombs on it?
Yes, that's right. human frailty will always surface somewhere along the line if you don't have standards and good practices and, you know, that sort of thing. So good security culture is very important.
I heard one... I mean, talking about nuclear war, I heard one statistic a number of years ago that up to 1963, when the above-ground tests were banned, that just America had exploded enough bombs that equaled 40,000 Hiroshima bombs that we just exploded as above-ground testing. That's not even counting Russia, you know, Britain, China, everyone. I mean, we've had a nuclear war, in essence. They just didn't declare it.
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with that statistic, but that seems reasonable, historical indicator. You know, it's interesting because, not to philosophize here, the nuclear weapons have only been detonated twice, at the end of World War II. And we've gone through a period since 1945, since August of 1945 until now, and they have not been used again. I mean, in terms of, intentional use of a nuclear bomb on somebody else. And we can either, ascribe to that luck or combination of luck plus also good planning with, some of these treaties and some of these programs that are out there. But a lot more, in my judgment, needs to be done because even though the probability is small that it might happen, the consequences are enormous. Mm-hmm. Without being dramatic, it would change the quality of life as we know it. It would affect travel. It would affect international commerce. It would affect our security, the way we live our lives, and so forth. If one of these things were to get into the wrong hands and, be detonated. Now, again, I don't want to be alarmist because the chances that happened are small, but the consequences are huge. And that's why we have to engage in these kinds of truly international cooperative efforts to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Right. Well, then obviously it's used for political purposes. With Iraq, we had the yellow cake, red yes. herring, that helped start a war there. Who do we trust? People like your organization to give us real facts?
Well, it's true. I mean, I think we can all question, I think, what happened in Iraq. I don't want to get into that at this point in time because it's a very sensitive issue. Maybe some other time we can chat about that. But you're absolutely right. And organizations such as the Partnership for Secure America and many others, not just here in the United States, but others around the world, need to be alternative sources of information and analysis and insight. To be second checks on information that is otherwise, secret information and intelligence services and so forth. It's a good governance means that there is multiple sources of information that checks off each other, and we don't always have that. I admit that.
Yeah. In terms of what's happening now, obviously Iran has been pushed as the arch villain and going to produce it, even though there's no evidence, they don't have it yet, and everyone agrees they don't. But yet we let the horse flew out of the stable with Pakistan. We have such a dichotomy there with that.
Yes, Pakistan's a difficult country for itself as well as others. It's a country that has perhaps, if China may be the exception, the fastest growing nuclear weapons arsenal.
Really?
A sizable number. I'm not quite sure what that number is, but it's substantial. It's a country that is not the most stable country in the world. It has a number of internal insurgencies. It's a weak government, divided government in many ways. Has a war next door in Afghanistan and some of its territories along the border. And its principal adversary, of course, as it sees it, is next door in India.
Is India, yeah.
Yeah, and so the concern is that an unstable state with nuclear weapons and an active nuclear program is obviously gives extreme pause and extreme worry. A country that has to be worry about and try to have a good working relationship with them, as well as to convince them and help them where we can to make sure that their facilities are secure and not infringed upon or infringable by other elements. The danger in Pakistan is not only that, you know, insurgencies and others might break into these facilities if they could, but also those who work inside the facilities are always a concern. So there's always the possibility of inside jobs that, not just in Pakistan, but any facility around the world are a concern. That was certainly true in Russia as well.
Well, that's true. Excuse me. Yeah, because when Russia broke up, that was a huge concern, breaking up the nuclear arsenal into all those, I know Kazakhstan has quite a nuclear arsenal.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we went from essentially one nuclear weapon state, the Soviet Union, into four, because Kazakhstan and Belarus and Ukraine inherited the nuclear weapons that were on their territory. Mm-hmm. And thanks to a number of programs, most notably the what's dubbed the Nunn-Lugar program, after Senators Nunn and Senator Lugar, developed a program here in the United States to provide resources and know-how to be able to assist those countries to remove those nuclear weapons, move them back to in a safe and secure way, back to Russia, where they were at least they were more secure than they would have been otherwise. Mm-hmm. And a number of other programs that were associated with that. It was a really remarkable program to provide assistance to a country that was our principal adversary for 50 years.
Yeah, really.
A terrific program.
Incredible. And, of course, talking about superpowers, we have to talk about China. And
absolutely.
I noticed, 9 years ago, you were on the China Security Review.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, what was this discussion then? And obviously China's come a long way now. How has that worked out after 10 odd years now?
Well, what happened was, just a brief history. Yeah. I hope if your audience is interested in this, and in the late 1990s, in the Senate, when I worked in the Senate at the time, the Congress was, at the request, I guess, of the Clinton administration, wanted to grant China most favored nation status, that we called it at the time. That was most favored nation status, one of those misnomers. It meant that we're not going to treat China any worse than anybody else, or any better for that matter. It was a controversial issue. So what happened was, in all candor, the House of Representatives created a commission on human rights with respect to China, and the Senate created this commission on our security, relationship with China, and a number of things. Both of them, quite frankly, were created, I think, so that members of Congress could go back to their constituents and say, well, I voted for most favored nation status, but we're going to watch China very closely with these commissions. And and the commissions were good ones. I was the executive director of the one for about a year and a half or 2 years, when we were looking at all the interactions that take place between the United States and China, trade interactions, and technology transfer, people flows, investments between the United States and China. We're trying to assess what impact it had on our security. It was a really good set of questions, and the commission still exists, by the way, so many years later.
Wow.
And it testifies before the Congress, and it provides a useful source of separate analyses about our relationship with China, which is now, you know, sort of jumping up to be perhaps the most important bilateral relationship we have, given the burgeoning economy of China and its growing military. This is a country that I think is a country that we're going to have to give even much more attention than the past.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that we aim our nuclear weapons at Russia. Do we aim them at China? Where does China aim their weapons?
That's a good question. I mean, you should ask the Chinese that. I think they probably do aim them at... probably most of them at Russia, I would think.
Okay.
I imagine they also have some aim this way, but I honestly don't know that. but they do have an active nuclear weapons program. There's no question about that.
Yeah,
they were the the fifth country to become a nuclear weapons state, and that took place in the 1960s.
Mm. And, do we have any idea of how many nuclear warheads they have?
There are various estimates of that. They have they certainly don't have the anywhere near the number of the U.S. and Russia. I think the estimate of the active nuclear weapons that exist in the world, the U.S. and Russia have well over 90% of them. But because we have so many, it's an artifact of the Cold War. And I think China I'm not sure the exact number, but I think, France and UK and China is probably the fourth or fifth largest number. But now Pakistan and India have a good number, and Israel as well.
That famous...
And North Korea.
Yeah. Oh, North Korea, yeah. I mean, obviously, Israel, it's all with a question mark, isn't it?
It is,
as they don't officially have them, but everyone acknowledges they have them.
That's right.
That is bizarre. And do they self-police it? Are they following the rules set out?
Well, they do and they don't, because both in the case of Israel, in the case of Pakistan, in the case of India, and now North Korea, they are not members or signatories. They've not ratified the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the international treaty obligations that are in that treaty, they are not bound by them. But the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does the inspections of civilian facilities around the world, and the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that does the inspections of civil facilities primarily to ensure that peaceful uses of nuclear technology and nuclear energy are not being diverted to military purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the IAEA does do inspections in Israel. They do inspections in Pakistan. They do inspections in India. They're no longer allowed to be in North Korea.
Okay.
They were kicked out. But in all those cases, the Israelis, the Pakistanis, and the Indians do not allow them to see certain facilities. In other words, they only allow them to see the ones that they want them to see, because they have certain things which they want to conceal. We do the same thing, but we are an acknowledged nuclear weapon state.
Okay.
The IAEA can come in and look at our military facilities, our civilian facilities.
Okay, interesting.
A long-winded explanation.
Yeah. No, it's so important to get the history of how things, why things happen, why we got to where we are. I mean,
yeah,
it's
we're
moving along that path. Now, you've moved along on many paths. You've been to over 40 countries, and you've monitored national elections.
Yes.
That sounds interesting. And tell us how that works.
Well, what happens, United States has developed something called the National Endowment for Democracy, and there are a number of organizations in the United States, and actually in other countries as well, that believe in free and fair elections, and they believe that free and fair elections and open societies are the best guarantee for promoting human freedom and actually... better commerce and the like. So when I was working in the U.S. Senate as a staffer, And then also outside, I've been invited to join delegations to go to the number of countries where they're having elections to monitor the elections. We have to be invited, of course. Countries are not going to allow you to come in because, well, they can deny you a visa, for example.
Right.
But when we are invited, we go in, and what we end up doing is talking to election officials, talking to the presidential candidates, if that's what's happening in the country, talking to voters, and get a sense of how free and fair the campaign was, how free and fair the election was, and issue reports, and to hold countries accountable for, you know, if they have something less than free and fair elections. It's a way of, you know, monitoring, and it's increased transparency, I think, is always a good thing if you're trying to promote open societies and open systems.
Right.
And so that's what we're doing. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be in observe two elections in Russia and a number in Central America, Philippines, Pakistan, South Korea, places like that. Romania was an interesting one.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, each one, all those, you know, different societies, yet striving for the same thing. That's interesting.
Yes, and then the individuals we see warms your heart. People just love when we come there, and they say, you come all this distance just to help us to have a free and fair election. You get a sort of lump in your throat when that happens.
Yeah.
Somebody who, you know, who maybe never voted before.
Right.
So, anyway, that's another story.
But how do people see us? I mean, I you know, we're big old America. We go in and crunch people, and yet we're very moralizing. Really, what are other countries' impressions of us?
It depends where you go and when you go as well, I think, and to whom you talk. I think generally the United States is very highly respected around the world. That's not true. It's not even. But we are admired, we are respected, and that level of admiration and respect, I think, ebbs and flows. I think right now in the Middle East, it's not very high, because obviously we fought and are fighting, certainly a war in Afghanistan, one in just in Iraq for, and still have some non-combatants there, in Libya. We're talking about Iran right now, and
right.
You know that that doesn't always leave favorable impressions in the Islamic states, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it was it was painfully funny watching Hillary Clinton sort of slowly backing off, you know, when the Arab Spring started gaining momentum, she had to somehow maneuver herself into another position. That was very interesting politically.
Well, we've had what some people regard as a contradiction. We, on the one hand, as we're just discussing, we promote through our foreign assistance, through our private contacts, institutions and practices, which we would like to see in countries to be more democratic, while at the same time oftentimes supporting regimes that are less than democratic.
Right.
I don't want to be dramatic about that, but it's like putting one foot on the brake and one foot on the accelerator. And what happens when you do that full force, you end up going in circles. sometimes it's necessary given the circumstances, and it's, you know, oftentimes a judgment call. But it doesn't always lead to long-lasting favorable outcomes.
Right. Fascinating. And one thing I hadn't talked about, obviously, the value, all these stockpiles, the plutonium, whatever, in the stockpiles, it's worth a lot of money. And obviously that's one of the reasons why, obviously, nefarious forces want to get hold of it.
No, you're absolutely right. There's, as I say, there's highly enriched uranium. Highly enriched uranium, the weapons usable uranium has to be enriched to what's called about 90%. And plutonium as well. These are weapons usable. they are there's a lucrative market out there, obviously, if in the black market. And every now and then there'll be an incident that is reported, usually through the IAEA in Vienna. For example, there, I think the statistic is there's something like 18 to 20 confirmed efforts that of lost or stolen HEU and or weapons usable HEU, highly enriched uranium and plutonium over the last 18 years or something like that. But there's even more so, there's about something like, I think, 2,000 confirmed incidents of efforts to engage in illicit trafficking of all kinds of hiding of all kinds of weapons, usable material, but also radiological materials, which we haven't talked about yet. Radiological materials are not weapons usable, but they are dangerous nonetheless. They're used, for example, in hospitals and clinics, in industry. And if not carefully handled, can be lethal. And one of the focuses of the Seoul Nuclear Summit, coming back to that, was to pay greater attention to radiological materials because they're not always as secure. Hospitals don't protect them that well as other places, including in the United States. And there have been a number of incidents where there have been some thefts, and those who handled them did not have the training, the experience with them, suffered death or dangers and so forth and so on. The other thing that's worrisome about that, just one last point on that, is that if a terrorist group were to get a hold of even that kind of material and wrap some explosives around them, they could do enormous damage.
Really?
Radiological damage in a crowded subway in a big city. We're talking about thousands of people might be, adversely affected. The economies would be disrupted for years, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another concern that we really have to pay attention to.
Was that Padilla bomb? Was that something in Chicago, the guy who was arrested for trying to make a bomb?
I don't know. I don't remember that particular case. But there was a famous case in Brazil. So this is the global issue. Brazil in the 1987, I think, where a certain quantity of radiological materials was stolen, and the handlers didn't know how to handle it, but they thought it was, something they could sell, I assume. And four of them died, and tens of thousands of people had to be evacuated and adversely affected and so on. So the impact on this kind of thing can be enormous. It's not a nuclear weapon per se, but it can have really devastating consequences nonetheless.
Yes, on a very more localized, but really nasty. Well, Andy Semmel, thank you so much for an intriguing interview. I mean, it's left me, I must admit, much more uneasy than I was already. How can people get more information about Partnership for Secure America and other groups?
Well, Partnership for Secure America, we have a website. It's obviously www.psaonline.org. Yeah, and it's one of our organizations. There's another group that I work with that is even more intensely involved in this. And we were all at the Nuclear Security Summit in Seoul. It's a long group called the Fissile Material Working Group. Fissile Material Working Group.
Working group. Okay.
And FMWG. And I think, I don't have their website on hand, but I think you could probably find that. They issue statements and lots of materials on this very, very frequently.
Oh, great. I'm so glad you're helping us and trying to keep the whole world safer. Thank you so much, Andy Semmel.
It's an important issue, and I think we're safer, but we're not safe enough
right.
as a result of these actions.
Exactly. I hope you keep continuing and those other passionate people trying to stop proliferation.
Well, thank you very much, and I enjoyed the conversation, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I'll be watching.
Right.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Based on a story I read the other day, it seems space aliens are coming to take us away.